Okay. Welcome, everyone, for the long-awaited, much-promised season two of the Jurisprudence Course podcast. I'm Scott Shapiro, your host, and I have two special co-hosts for this season. Definitely among the smartest people I've ever met. One of them is my colleague, Gideon Yaffe, who is the Wesley Newcomb Hofeld Professor of Jurisprudence at Yale Law School. And the other one co-host is Mitch Berman, who is the Leon Meltzer Professor of Law at the University of Pennsylvania, and wrote and put together a phenomenal book with Rich Friedman from the University of Michigan on the jurisprudence of sports. And so what we're going to do this season, we're going to have a bunch of episodes where we talk about various issues in the jurisprudence and philosophy of sport. And before we start, I want to just mention that Mitch, maybe you could just tell everyone the name of the book and where one could purchase it if they wanted to.
Well, sure. Thanks so much, Scott. Great to be here. Great to be spending time with you and with you, Gideon. I did write a book co-authored with my colleague and my former teacher at the University of Michigan. It's called The Jurisprudence of Sport, Sports and Games as Legal Systems. It's published by West Publishing. It is a textbook, and while I would love for people to go out and buy it, I wouldn't really expect it. It's a textbook and it's pricier than your regular book. Maybe it's on Amazon.
Well, we'll throw well, well I'll throw up a link for those who are interested in it. It's a really, really, it is a textbook, a case book, but it's extremely well done. It's extremely readable. It's really fascinating stuff. I should just say that this season's podcast is sponsored by Fancy Bear Goes Fishing. The Dark History of the Information Age and Five Extraordinary Hacks by Scott Shapiro. Thanks for the sponsor for funding this season. Okay, and Gideon, before we got on, you told us a fascinating thing about your experience with Major League Baseball. And I mean, in a way, it's one of the reasons why you're one of the co-hosts. So can you just talk about that?
Sure. Well, so let me put it this way. The very first time that I caught a ball at a major league ballpark, I was on my cell phone when the ball came, and I caught the ball and thought for sure I was going to be on the Jumbotron since I was holding the phone in one hand and caught the ball in the other. But they didn't put me on the Jumbotron, but didn't matter because it was really the most exciting moment of my life. I mean, honestly, like it had been a dream since I was a tiny kid. And then over the next couple years, maybe 3 years, I didn't catch just one more. I didn't catch just two more. I caught three more. I caught four balls all at Dodger Stadium. And yeah, so each of these is I got the newspaper for that day, for the whole newspaper for that day, and I put them in a bag and I described in like a couple paragraphs how I felt about the event, which was very meaningful, and those are all in a box in my house. So there you
Okay.
go. Yeah.
You're...
So not like this subject comes from nowhere from my
No,
point of view.
I understand. I mean, there's been, I mean, we make it seem so simple and so easy, but there have been many decades of training for this moment.
Exactly.
Yeah, don't think, oh, okay, I can start my own jurisprudence of sports podcast. We're professionals, people. Okay, so let's just start by just saying, so we're teaching this course. All three of us are teaching this course at Yale this semester, and we meet each Thursday for 2 hours with students, and we talk about things. So what we're going to do is we're going to be roughly following the classes that we've been doing. We taught this class about 3 weeks ago. This will be the introductory class, so virtually nothing of importance will be said. Let's let me just start off with a little music. Okay, so that was Walk of
Very
Life.
little music.
Yeah, very little. Yeah, well, we have to get down to business. Okay, so the first thing I want to ask Mitch, because you put together the book and you've spent lots and lots of time thinking about the subject of the jurisprudence of sports. But I want to talk about like jurisprudence of sports is a subfield of the philosophy of sports. And I will just say that I had never heard of the philosophy of sports. I was delighted to hear that there was such a subject. And I was wondering if you could tell the audience and us, like, what in the world is the philosophy of sports?
Sure. Well, you're not alone in being a good philosopher who's not yet attuned to the philosophy of sport. But the philosophy of sport has been around for 50 years or so. In some sense, of course, it could be around since the dawn of history or prehistory. But in terms of a recognized sub-discipline within philosophy, philosophy of sport has been around for at least half a century. It sports, if you will, a couple of, or supports certainly, a couple of different philosophy journals. The main one in the field is the Journal of the Philosophy of Sport. And that, I think, recently celebrated its 50th anniversary.
Wow.
So
I was
it's been around for a while. And as you'd imagine, the philosophy of sport is a pretty, oh, undisciplined, tentacular field. It's all sorts of philosophical sub-disciplines applied to a particular domain of human existence, sport. So it asks conceptual questions or metaphysical questions. What is sport? What are sports? What are games? What's the relationship between sports and games? It asks ethical questions concerning the permissibility or propriety of engaging in various types of sports or games. It asks aesthetic questions, whatever questions aestheticians might ask about any domain. Those philosophical questions could be asked about sports and are asked about sports. They're questions in critical theory. So, as I say, pretty much any type of philosophical question could be asked about sports.
Can I ask you a question about that? I'm just curious, like, I mean, so a lot of the way you've just described it sounds like you get to publish an article in the Journal of the Philosophy of Sport if you've written about sport. But what if you've written an article about, basketball? Does that the kind of thing that gets, I mean, there might be philosophical questions that are specific to basketball or addressed specifically to basketball. Does that get published in there too, or?
It doesn't have to be questions about sport as such or the genus sport. Of course, it could be questions about particular sports, so long as it's of a sufficiently philosophical character. And what makes it of a philosophical character isn't addressed within the Journal of the Philosophy of Sport or the Philosophy of Sport. That would be addressed within the Journal of the Philosophy of Philosophy, I suppose.
Right.
So there are.
Let me how did you get interested in it?
Well, I got interested in it really from a jurisprudence of sport perspective. So, what is the jurisprudence of sport? I take it to be a subcategory within the philosophy of sport. Roughly, it's the philosophy of law as applied to sport. Or you might think of it as the philosophy of whatever is the larger category that includes both sport and law as applied to sport. And I got interested in it really, since we're just friends here, I'll tell you the truth. I watch a lot of
No
sports.
one's going to be listening, so go ahead.
Right.
That's sort of what I'm counting on. I watch a lot of sports. And I'm married and have children. My children are older now than they used to be, if you can believe that. And there was a time when my wife would come in and question how much sports I was watching. So I thought I needed
And
to
your
give it
answer was,
time.
I'm working.
Exactly, Gideon. Exactly. You know me too well. So one thing I could have done if I were a good father and husband, I would say, I hear what you're saying, honey, and I'm going to turn off the TV. But being a better shirker and possibly a better philosopher than I'm a husband or father, I said I need to come up with a work angle that could justify my spending so much time watching TV. So that's sort of it. But I would say a little bit in my defense, it didn't require a whole lot of effort on my part, because if you're a philosophically minded person, then philosophical questions arise in your mind with respect to all sorts of things that engage you. And because I'm engaged by watching and thinking about sports, philosophical questions just occur to me unbidden, as I'm
Can
sure I know they do of you.
you just give me one example, or us one example of like thoughts that have occurred to you while watching I don't know, basketball or football or whatever?
Yes, and in fact, it is a really timely question and a really timely answer. So my first article on the jurisprudence of sport, in fact, in the article that coined the term, the jurisprudence of sport, was published in 2011, and I probably wrote it in 2009, and it was in response to watching tennis. I was watching the US Open semifinals of the women's draw of the US Tennis Open, September 2009. Serena Williams was playing against Kim Clijsters, and she was down one set to love. And she was serving down 3 games to 5 in the second set. So if she loses this game, then she loses the second set, and because women's matches, even at the Grand Slams, are best 2 out of 3 sets, she would lose the match and therefore lose the semifinals if she lost that game. So she's down 15-30 and she's serving second serve, and she's called for a foot fault on the second serve. And because she's called for a foot fault on the second serve when she's serving 15-30, that makes it 15-40, which makes it double match point to Kim Clijsters because of a foot fault call. And it was a very ticky-tack foot fault call.
Ticky-tack.
It was, if you could imagine a foot fault being a big foot fault, like you step all the
Oh,
way over the line, or
I
just
see.
your toe touches the line, it was of the latter sort. I mentioned that.
Just not everyone is familiar with the philosophical jargon that we use, ticky-tack. So,
Yes, yeah, I think that
yes.
was, comes from the German
The high German.
Right. So then she complained about the call, by the way. I just mentioned this part for those who might recall the incident. She started complaining about the call. Serena Williams, goes over to the line judge and threatens the line judge. Ultimately, she's hit with a point penalty for her response to the foot fault call. And because the foot fault was on a second serve, making it double match point, when she's hit with a point penalty for complaining about it and threatening to shove her racket down the line judge's throat, she loses the match. Okay. Now, John McEnroe,
I
who's
would
the
just be so pissed if I had paid a lot of money for that match. I mean, oh
no,
my God. Like to be cheated out of my third set, but I mean, I would have beat the crap out of that ref.
Actually, one of the things we're really going to talk about is like what's the aim of sports? And if the aim of sports is entertainment or amusement, is that's that call went in the wrong direction. But I mean, I
Yeah.
imagine what you were like as a good as an experienced philosopher, you'd be like, what? Like, is that right? What was the question that occurred to you?
Well, it wasn't hard to for it to occur to me. It was just served up on a silver platter. John McEnroe, who's the color guy calling the match for CBS at the time, says, "Ah, you don't call that there. You don't call that there. You don't call a ticky-tack foul at crunch time." Okay. And that struck me as right. pre-theoretically, unreflectively, it struck me as a knowledgeable or at least experienced sports fan that McEnroe was saying something that wasn't novel to him, but was channeling a very familiar reaction to sports fans across the sporting universe, which is let them play, swallow the whistle, don't call minor fouls at crunch time toward the end of close contests. Now,
I
why
think
do I?
even Clyster's fans would have been on that side. I mean, it doesn't have anything to do with whether your person benefits. I mean,
Right, yeah, it's just a shitty match, right?
I would say this. I don't know whether Clyster's fans would feel that way, but tennis fans who aren't only Serena fans certainly would, right? Now, why do I say that it's really timely that we discuss this at this moment? And you don't know why. And that tells me that you guys are not, for all your virtues, either big football fans, or if you are, your memory isn't very good, or you didn't watch the Super Bowl.
I didn't watch the Super Bowl. Did you?
Okay.
Did you watch
So
the
you
Super
can
Bowl?
kick
I
off the
watched the Super
podcast now.
Bowl. Yeah. No, I
Okay.
watched the Super Bowl, but I actually don't know what you mean from this.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I'm going to bet that most of your listeners do, because the Super Bowl ended with, nearly ended, with 1 minute and 54 seconds to go. There was a very controversial defensive holding call against James Bradberry, defensive back for the Eagles. So James Bradberry held a receiver for the Chiefs, but it was a very
Ticky tacky. It was ticky.
exactly
Yeah, it
right.
was
It was
ticky
a
tacky.
ticky
All right.
tack hold.
I wasn't a fan of either side, but it did not seem ticky tacky to me.
But in any event, it sure seemed ticky tack to Greg Olsen. Greg Olsen, who was the broadcaster, the color commentator on the Fox broadcast. And he, channeling John McEnroe from 12 and a half years earlier, shouted, "Let him play! Let him play! You don't call a ticky tack foul at that moment." So there are a couple of questions. One, of course, is was it a ticky tack holding foul? Let's assume that it was. That's a fact question. But assume that it was a foul, but it was a modest one. On those facts, the fact pattern just replicates the Serena Williams episode from, as I say, a dozen and a half years earlier. And in both cases, pretty knowledgeable experts had the instinct that the right thing to do there is not to enforce a penalty, not to call the infraction, even though the infraction was committed according to the rules of the game. So just to jump back in time, there I am watching the event on live on TV, and my reaction was, yeah, I hear what McEnroe's saying, and that seems right to me. But when you pause to ask yourself, why is he right? What justifies a practice of not calling ticky-tack fouls at crunch time? It's not immediately obvious what the answer is, or at least I should say it wasn't immediately obvious to me. It might well be immediately obvious to both of you guys, but it wasn't immediately obvious to me, so I thought that's an interesting question. Can we vindicate those widespread sporting intuitions? Or, contrary-wise, can we show that actually there's really nothing to it, it's just prejudice, there's really no good argument that would support the intuition that you let them play? So that was my first article.
Wow, that's fascinating, not only as a problem, but the fact that it recurs, and it recurs in these big events, and where these questions arise, despite the fact that the people who are true, like real experts, have very strong intuitions in one direction. I was just curious, when you wrote the article, did you come out, where did you come out?
Well, like in much of my stuff, I came out sort of straddling a fence or refusing to commit to something really sharp-edged.
You know
You
what?
know, I'll tell you what.
What?
This actually recur. This is in the case book.
Okay. So
So it's a
we'll get to it,
teaser.
right? We'll get to it.
A teaser. Yeah. Pay
Okay, a teaser. No,
attention.
that's
Come
right.
back
You,
for episode seven.
no, no, that's right. I mean, Look, I'll just tell you that our sponsor's an asshole, so that's good. We really need these people to come back. Okay. I mean, when you're talking about the ticky-tack stuff, I was thinking of just like, in the law, we have this thing called a de minimis rule. Like when there's like a when the when there's a tiny infraction, you go a little bit over the rule. You're like, whatever, whatever. But sometimes we actually hold people to ticky-tack things, and sometimes we don't. And that's a really interesting question. Should you do that? So we'll take this up again. I'd like to throw out the next question, which is, why is this an interesting? I mean, obviously these are interesting set of questions, but why would it be interesting and helpful for a legal philosopher or legal theorists? To think about why are we teaching this together in a law school? And so you know what, let me throw this to Gideon. Maybe you could start us off, and then I'll follow, and then Mitch. Like what kind of connections do you see between the jurisprudence of sports and legal philosophy?
Oh, I mean, I think there's a lot of connections. So some of them have been hinted at in some of the things that Mitch said. So, what are legal systems? They're groups of rules, basically, or groups of demands, and violations of them are adjudicated in various ways. And this is at that level of description, which is pretty, high level and abstract. That's also true of games and sports. I mean, what are they? They're just systems of rules, and they get adjudicated in various ways. And so exactly what they have in common, why they make demands on people, why they have authority of any kind, like why it is that players of chess, shouldn't move the rook on diagonals, or why it is that, people shouldn't jaywalk in violation of the law. These are both systems of rules that are making demands on us, and why it's so. If there's differences, it'd be really fascinating to understand what those differences are. I mean, I think we'd learn a lot about law by understanding what the difference is in the demands that sports make on us, as opposed to the demands that law makes on us. So that's the main thing. And then also, then I don't know. I'm just like kind of obsessed with wrongdoing, like people acting wrongly and what it is to be responsible for acting wrongly. And that also arises in sports, so people can act in violation of the rules, and then, when are they responsible for that? And does it matter? I mean, does it matter whether we care whether they're responsible or not? And should we examine their mental states? He didn't really mean to, do the thing that he did. And does that matter in sports? That kind of question is just incredibly fascinating to me. And partly, I mean, I guess my interest in it is mostly just an intrinsic interest, but I do think it's really important for understanding law better, which I feel some sort of, I don't know, professional obligation to do. So, yeah.
No, I mean, listeners who listen to the first season will know that sports, since comes up in jurisprudential writing, Hart in, was it chapter 6 of The Concept of Law, tries to get some purchase on what judges are doing when they apply the law by analogizing the case of the judge to an umpire referee in a sports game. Talks about scorer's discretion and all that stuff. These questions about games and sports routinely come up in jurisprudential conversations. And the reason why they do, again, for people who've listened to the previous season, know that, like, the way I think about it is like when you do philosophy of law, it's super, super helpful to try to see what is like law, just less complex. And so the things about sports is that it feels law-like, but it feels manageable. Like when I looked at the Major League Baseball rules, what there's like 150 pages of rules, but they're very detailed, and then you can actually read them, like in an hour or so, and you can kind of think about it and analyze it and discuss it as we've been doing in class. And that just creates a model of how to think about the law. So one of the things that we did last week and which we'll do in like 2 or 3 weeks is philosophers, of course, are obsessed with what kinds of rules does law have. And one of the things we talked about last season was the distinction between power conferring and duty imposing rules. Well, the same sorts of questions arise when it comes to games and sports. Are there power conferring rules in sports? Are there duty imposing rules in sports? Are there constitutive rules? Are there regulative rules? All these kinds of theoretical constructs that we'll bring up to help us understand the law often got their start by thinking about games and sports as a model. So I think the philosophy and jurisprudence of sports is an incredibly helpful way of entering into a much more complex phenomenon, which is legal systems.
And not just actually do sports include these various rules that we find in law, but think about it from the point of view of a designer. Do you end up with a better sport?
Right.
If you include some of these rules or leave out others or use them in some circumstances or not in others.
Absolutely.
And even what does it mean to be a better sport? It seems like it means something, but the huge complicated philosophical question, what exactly it means.
Right, exactly. What we're going to, the next part, we're going to talk about exactly that question in PGA versus Martin, which really raises that question in a very stark form. Before we move on to Mitch, what about you? Why do you think we should be? Why do you think we're allowed to teach this here?
Well, I figure at Yale you're allowed to teach anything. The hard question is, why would someone be allowed to teach it elsewhere? I agree with everything you guys said, of course, but I'm going to toss out two other considerations about why attention to sports might be a particularly good angle of entry into questions about law, philosophical and otherwise. One is that the stakes are lower, and they're in a way that might be helpful in reducing types of biases which can cloud our thinking. So down the road, at 1 week, we'll be talking about rule interpretation in sports. Remember, of course, Chief Justice John Roberts, during his confirmation hearings, analogized the judge to the umpire, right? So the judge and the umpire both interpret the provisions to try to figure out what the law is or what the rules are, something like this. But in ordinary law, especially constitutional law, one of the areas I teach and write in, our thoughts about that are going to be either informed or affected, depending upon how you look at it, by a sense of the stakes. For example, if we're trying to decide between originalism and non-originalism as theories of constitutional interpretation, most of us are going to have a strong eye toward, what's this going to mean for something I care about? The right to abortion or affirmative action or who knows what. And that could be good or it could be distracting, right? Whereas in sport, the stakes are lower. I just gave you an example before about a puzzle that I spent some time thinking about because of the way it arose in this tennis match. And I could say I'm not a partisan of either Serena Williams or Kim Clijsters. I like tennis, but I don't think there was much danger that the way I would think about that would be infected in a bad way by my result-orientedness. The last thing I'll say, which is sort of related to that, is just that we know a lot about sports, and especially our students do, and they know way more about sports than they do about law yet. So it's hard for them to ask second order questions about law when they don't know the first order stuff. But I do think we ought to take our intuitions, our solid intuitions about things very seriously, not intransigently, but it's useful to getting clarity on things, understanding it better, if we can consult some of our intuitions. Maybe those intuitions will mislead us, but maybe for the enterprise of reflective equilibrium, of course, we need to start with some case-specific views. Like, yeah, I sort of think John McEnroe is right. I sort of think, yeah, you don't call that there. So we can mobilize existing intuitions of the students, which often are pretty strongly held and often also surprisingly nuanced,
Right.
that people have a sense, yeah, you do this in this context, but in this slightly different context, things really change. So if we can mobilize and marshal those intuitions, I think that's really helpful in
Right, I right,
our
absolutely. So right, so it's not just the case that sports are like less complex legal systems, but they seem less morally freighted. Number two, and also they're not esoteric in the way in which law is an esoteric practice, because professional practice, where, and one of the strange things, and of course I'm not a big sports person, but the weird thing is that so many normal people are like they really care about sports. They spend a portion of their weekend, they read about it. And so it is strange that philosophers should, I mean, I guess it's not strange because they're philosophers, but ignore things that normal people do to try to understand it. It's and so the point you make is a really excellent one. It's really great for people who don't have a professional legal education yet, but can ask many of the same sorts of questions. And the point that Gideon raised about, like, if you're really interested in wrongdoing and responsibility and like what proper punishment should be, I guess we've all played sports. We've been in a lot of those kinds of situations when we were kids, or maybe even as adults. So I mean, yeah, that makes a those make strong cases for the subject. I just teaching it because I really wanted to teach it with you guys.
Can I make
Yeah,
a really
please.
quick, this is like, I don't know how important this is, but it just occurred to me when Mitch was talking about the moral freightedness or the non-moral freightedness of sports as it being an advantage, right? And there's another kind of aspect of that, which is, so conversationally, if somebody says, I'm in favor of originalism, and you say, well, you just feel that way because you're pro-life. That's kind of an insult, right? It's like saying, where if somebody says, I think that McEnroe was 100% right, that shouldn't have been called. It's like not an insult to say the only reason you feel that way is because you're a Serena Williams fan. You know what I mean? It's not like, I mean, it's the same mistake, but it's somehow calling somebody out on the mistake in sports seems fine in a way where it seems kind of iffy in the legal domain.
Yeah, really. Yeah, right. So motivated reasoning, right? All of sports is motivated reasoning, right? You're rooting, in some, not all of sports is motivated reasoning, but there's so much of it. But we the rule of
Not
law,
an insult to point that out.
it's not an insult to point that out, but it's threatening to and undermining of the rule of law and legal practice to actually the maybe constantly say it, or for everyone to say it. There's a there's a there's It's impolite to say it because it really is undermining of the practice to do
Yeah,
it.
exactly. Yeah.
And so to say that somebody's result oriented is usually an insult. So it's not just that sports raises a lot of the same kind of philosophical questions that arise in law, but the law often has to grapple with these sorts of philosophical, jurisprudential-like questions. And the kind of the paradigmatic case of this is the Supreme Court case of PGA versus Martin, which raised a fascinating case and a really interesting discussion. So maybe I'm gonna let me throw this over to Mitch. Maybe he can kind of give us the background on it and some ranges of views about what the proper result was in the case. And we won't really get into it much today. I want to throw it out, and then this case will recur. So Mitch, why don't you tell us about it?
Well, PGA Tour versus Martin was a 2001 Supreme Court case. I bet it would be familiar to a bunch of your listeners. And it involved a challenge brought by Casey Martin, who's a professional golfer, who had a degenerate circulatory disorder in his leg, which really prevented him from being able to walk the course. It was extremely painful, and there were some real dangers. He could break his leg. It could cause, could require an amputation. So he had very good reasons why he was a really good golfer, but he couldn't walk the course. And the PGA Tour, which is the competitive professional, the Professional Golfers Association, has a tour rule that on the tour, golfers have to walk the course. They can't ride in a cart. That is not a rule of golf as the sport, as most weekend duffers know. You can ride a cart and you're still playing golf, but not if you're playing in the PGA Tour. So Casey Martin asked the PGA Tour to give him an exemption, and they refused. At which point he filed a lawsuit alleging that the tour's refusal to grant him an exemption, allowing him to ride in a cart during the tour, during a competition, violated the Americans with Disability Act. The Americans with Disability Act is a federal law that requires entities, business entities, to make reasonable accommodations for persons with whom they interact who have disabilities. That could be your customers, it could be your employees. So, for example, if someone is blind, then the employer might be required to hire someone or provide other mechanism by which the person could do their job, even though they're not sighted. So Martin said, look, the Pro Golfers Association tours are covered by the Americans with Disabilities Act. That requires covered entities to make accommodations if they would be reasonable. And what are reasonable accommodations? Those are accommodations that would not fundamentally alter the nature of the activity. So, first question for the court is the PGA Tour covered by the ADA at all? That's a question that I'm not interested in myself, although you guys might well be. For my purposes, I'm just assuming that the court got it right, because that's the necessary predicate for the interesting questions, okay? And that question is, what is a reasonable accommodation? Or put another way, would the accommodation that would require the PGA Tour to allow Casey Martin to ride in the cart, would that be a fundamental alteration of the activity? And to answer that question required the court to investigate what is the essence of, I should say, to answer that question caused the court to at least think it had to answer these following questions. Maybe it didn't, but it started investigating what is the essence of golf? What is the essence of golf as such? What is the essence of golf as played on the PGA Tour? And therefore, would it be a fundamental alteration? If it's the essence of golf that you have to walk, then of course, giving the exemption would fundamentally alter the activity. If walking is not an essential or fundamental part of the activity, even when competed on the professional tour, then an accommodation might well be required by the act. And that's the big question that members of the court divided on.
Right, and without going through the reasoning now, because we'll pick it up next week, what does the court hold?
Well, the court holds two things. First, that the tour is a covered entity. And then second, that the essence of golf as it's played on the PGA Tour is shot making, which anyone would agree with, while battling fatigue.
Ah.
So It's not if Casey Martin wasn't fatigued enough by his condition, and if the riding in the cart didn't add fatigue, then he wouldn't be granted an exemption because fatigue, according to the majority, was an important fundamental or essential part of professional golf. But walking is only instrumental in inducing fatigue. It is not itself independently fundamental or essential to the activity, according to the majority opinion, written, I should say, by John Paul Stevens, an active, energetic amateur golfer himself. So, given that they said Martin can does get fatigued even without riding, we could do away without the riding without cutting into the essence of the activity. The dissent, Justice Scalia wrote a dissent joined by Justice Thomas, and he dissented on two bases. First, he said the Americans with Disability Act just doesn't, as a matter of interpreting the act, doesn't apply to things like the Pro Golfers Association tours. He could be right about that. He could be wrong about that. Not really a philosophy of sport question. That's a matter of interpreting the statute. The other question is sort of a matter of, so to speak, interpreting the sport. And Scalia and Thomas dissented on that second question as well. So they said, even assuming for sake of argument that the majority has it right, that the statute does apply to the Pro Golfers Association tours, there's no sense to be made of the majority's determination by judges about what is or is not fundamental or essential to this particular practice. It's either, and I think you and I and Gideon might have slightly different reads of the opinion, but he's either saying there's no answer to what's fundamental or essential to golf, or whatever it is something that the Pro Golfers Association has unbridled discretion to answer. Whatever answer the PGA Tour gives to that question, that is necessarily the right answer.
Okay, so we will talk about this next class, but I just, do you, I maybe you even have the quote there, but Justice Scalia said something very strong, made a very strong claim about the nature of rules in a game or in sports. And because of this, if you will, philosophical jurisprudential view about the relationship between rules and sports, he thought he and Justice Thomas thought that there was no there was nothing for the court to decide. It was completely arbitrary what rules were part of the sport and what rules were not. Do you have the exact quote?
Yeah, I know why you remember this because, as you say, this is the opinion in which Justice Scalia said some strong, unnuanced things, right? Then this is the opinion, right?
Right, exactly. I was trying to think which case was he outspoken and maybe
Yes, this was it.
was a bit over his skis in terms of the language.
So he says two things. One is he says that the rules are the rules of golf, and the rules in golf, as in all games, are entirely arbitrary. So that's a passage that I like a lot. There's another passage which I'm not finding right now where he says, oh, here it is. Here's the other passage. It is the very nature of a game to have no object except amusement. So those are two claims that I think are worthy of interrogation, that it is the very nature of a sport as a game to have no object except amusement. And then secondly, the rules of all games are entirely arbitrary.
Right. Yeah. So those are, so let's have that float out there, in the sense that we'll pick this up next week. Obviously this, you know, it's, we don't have to ask, is this a philosophical question? Like, 'cause at least the way you just stated it, it's like a classic philosophical question. What's the relationship between rules and their constituent games, one thing you could say is they're completely arbitrary because the game is just the set of rules. Or you could say that, well, what is the aim of sports? Well, the aim of sports is just amusement. That's why we do it. And these are classic philosophical claims, which actually benefit from philosophical inquiry and analysis, which we will pick up next week. I'm gonna close. I'm gonna close this down for now, unless anybody else has anything else they'd like to jump in and say. Anybody? No. Okay.
Just that I'm glad to be here. It's a
Oh,
treat to be
yeah.
chatting with
Thanks, Scott. Thanks for putting it together.
Okay. Sure. No. We're gonna. We always go out with some music because music is what makes people buy books. So please buy Fancy Bear Goes Fishing, The Dark History of the Information Age, and Five Extraordinary Hacks, available for pre-order wherever quality books are sold. Thank you very much, gentlemen. We'll see you next week. Bye-bye.